This is Audible.
John Dies at the End by David Wong. Narrated by Stephen Thorne. Chapter 10. The Missing Girl. In the summer of the year after the Wexler thing, I realized someone was watching me through my television. I could sense it, the way you sense someone staring at your back, a presence behind the screen, a pair of watching eyes. I ignored it as long as I could, telling myself no one would want to secretly watch a single 23-year-old on his couch eating Taco Bell bean burritos day after day, 80 cents apiece, two and a Coke for $3. But I knew better, of course. There were apparently parties who had a very good reason to keep eyes on me at this point, aside from my perfectly sculpted statue of David Buttocks. One night, with the television on some History Channel special about history's top 10 deadliest warships or some shit, I turned away from the TV and toward the mirror on the far wall. I went to pull a brush through my knotted hair and froze. I had glimpsed the TV playing in the reflection over my shoulder. A face. It was an oddly shaped face, with features that were human, but off. A Michael Jackson face, a face like a mask. Wide, two large eyes, a nose not quite centered. Looking right at my back from the TV, plain as day. I spun on the television, the hairbrush flying from my hand, a terrorized breath sucking through my teeth. Back to normal now, the Bismarck getting sunk in a plume of smoke. Again, I suppose most people would have feared a mental illness at that point. By now, though, mental illness would just mean some tests and a prescription. Big deal. No, my fear was of somebody actually watching me through my fucking television. I told John about it, and he came right over, as a best friend would. We cursed at the television for half an hour. Then he dropped his pants and pressed his balls against the screen. Like he said, there was no need to change our routine. He suggested I get some rest, that I was stressed because of Jennifer, who had moved in and then moved back out again twice in the last 6 months. Then we drank and played PlayStation hockey until the sun came up. That became my routine for weeks after, sleeping too little and drinking too much and playing too much hockey. Things started to spin out of control. Soon we were playing without the goalies, skating 6-on-6 and scoring games 74-68. Finally, when we started both playing on the same side, Red Wings, against an inept team controlled by the computer AI and winning the games 126-0, I knew I had hit rock bottom. I also knew I was still being watched. I knew this was a bad sign, that things were moving again, that I had to get my head on straight. I threw out the bottles and shaved my face and even considered cleaning the house. I started ironing my shirts again. Somebody mailed me a little bottle of what they claimed was holy water, and I kept it on my nightstand. I hung a garage sale crucifix from my front door. Then, just after Christmas, things got weird again. The end began when I came home from work on a frigid Friday night. I was plowing my truck through the worst winter storm the area had seen in years, the world looking like the aftermath of God's snow cone machine explosion. I pushed in through the front door, snow melting off my leather coat. A prickly fever sweat was breaking out all over me as my skin adjusted to the 50-degree temperature difference between my living room and the night air outside. The wind shifted, the whole house creaked. There was a tinkling of ice chips flicking off the windows. I had just left a nightmarish 16-hour soul-numbing double shift at Wally's video rental Orifice. The night manager had claimed she couldn't get out in the storm and asked if I could please work for her, saying that she owed me big time, and that I was such a sweetheart, and that if I ever needed anything, anything at all, just let her know. I don't think she meant that. But I put my head down and plowed through a 1,000-minute, dead-quiet, customer-free battle against exhaustion and my urge to beat my co-workers to death. Now I just wanted to dry off and curl up in. I saw something out of the corner of my eye that stopped me in mid-thought. I leaned back to see through the open door of my bedroom. The drawer on my nightstand was open. The drawer where I keep my gun. My butt cheeks clenched so tightly that not even light could have escaped. I listened for burglar sounds. Dead quiet. I took a step forward, wondering if I could fake kung fu if I had to. I once saw Arnold Schwarzenegger kill a man in a movie by grabbing his head and twisting it until the neck broke. Was that difficult? Could a man do it without a lot of practice? I keep the gun in a hollowed-out copy of the Quran that John got me for Christmas. and there the big book was, tossed on the bed, open, and gunless. Nothing else disturbed. They actually checked my Quran to see if there was a gun inside. I knew I was dealing with a sick son of a bitch. I stepped carefully and quietly through the bedroom doorway, glancing this way and that. Nobody here. I checked under the bed, the sheets still smelling faintly of girl even now, months after I'd spent my last naked night on them with Jen. Or maybe it was my imagination. Either way, you should probably change those sheets. Nothing under the bed. I checked the other rooms in the dark little house, stepping slowly across the carpet. Somebody had called, I noticed, the little red new message light on my answering machine blinking in the darkness like a time bomb. Nobody here. I wandered toward the answering machine, my gut full of snakes. Snow melted in my hair, a droplet of ice water running into my ear. I reached up to brush it back and sucked in a shocked breath. I had found the pistol. It was in my motherfucking hand. I dropped the gun like it was made of bees. It bounced onto the sofa, and I stared stupidly at it. Then stared even more stupidly at my empty palm, fingers pink from the cold. What the? Now that you ask, it's a whole 10-foot walk from your heated truck to your front door. Why does every inch of exposed skin feel windburned? Why do you seem to have a pint of snow in your hair? There's that feeling again, that fluttery feeling of mental weightlessness. Like the times when you wake up in the dark, on the hood of a car, a bottle in your hand, no idea what day it is, some girl shouting at you in Arabic. I tried to collect myself. Tired. Tired like a zombie. An overworked zombie. One who got hired as a salaried assistant manager at a zombie video store. Only to find out salary just means he doesn't get paid for overtime. My skull pounded. My knees were ground glass. I sat heavily on the sofa and stared vacantly at the little beads of water standing on the sleek chrome surface of the Smith. I glanced at my watch. Right after midnight. Okay, you got off at 11. You came straight home. It's a 12-minute drive, figure maybe 20 for the weather. You came right in. So where did the other half hour go, Dave? Did you maybe take a detour and shoot your boss? No. If I'd shot Wally's manager, Fred Wolfleg, I wouldn't have deprived myself by repressing the memory, would I? I picked up the gun and ejected the magazine, still heavy with bullets. I sighed with relief. If I had indeed stopped by Jeff's house to murder him, I would have emptied the gun. I reinserted the magazine. This was no way to start the weekend. I punched the play button on the machine, listened to the message. It was John. It finished. I hit play again, listened closer, then hit play again. By the fourth time, I was pretty sure that John had said, "Bag full of fat." I decided to try once more. Beep! Dave, it's me. Amy's missing, and we got what looks like a bag full of fat here. It's weird. And I mean bad weird, not clown weird. It's almost midnight, and I guess you're not home yet. Or maybe you're in bed. You're not in bed, are you? I know you haven't been sleeping. Are you there? Wake up, David. Wake up. Okay, so you're not there. Call me when you get this. I don't care how late. Oh, and when you come over, watch out for a jellyfish. See ya. Beep. Bag full of fat. I picked up the phone and dialed John on his cell. One ring, and then, I told you to leave me the fuck alone, Vinny. John? Oh, Dave, sorry. I'd just been having a heated argument here on my phone, and then I hung up in disgust. Then when the phone rang, I just assumed, without checking, that it was the person I was having an argument with, so I just blindly shouted insults into the phone. How embarrassing. I'm getting sick of that one, John. Are you on your way over? I got something going on here. What's your thing? I paused, made a decision. Batch of brownies in the oven. I don't want them to burn, or else they get gummy. Yeah, they'll stick, too. Did you grease the pan? Yeah. Good. Anyway, Amy is missing, and the scene is weird as shit. The situation has a real Lovecraft feel to it. Though, you know, if you come over, it'll be more of an Anne Rice situation. If you know what I mean. Because you're gay. Who's missing, John? Amy, Dave. A-M-Y. I think my signal's breaking up. I don't know any. Amy Sullivan, Big Jim's sister? That stopped me. Memories of an entire day spent locked in the back of a truck, sick with fear and boredom. A promise made to a dead man. I hadn't thought of that day in months.
Oh, you mean cucumber?
Do you not feel the need to learn people's real names, Dave? We called her that in school. She was in that special ed class, always throwing up for some reason. A silent pause on John's end.
You know, like a sea cucumber? There are these eels that...
Anyway, Dave, we're at her house now. The cops, too. How soon can you be here?
How about June?
Even that wasn't going to be enough time to piece this together. I pictured Big Jim on his back, a crimson stain across his neck and the floor like a scarf. The dead man had circled back into my life somehow. I glanced at the gun, trying to make it all fit, and failing.
What'd you say on my machine? Bag full of...
I can't hear you. You're breaking up. Just get here as soon as you can. We gotta go deal with this flying jellyfish thing. A pause on my end now.
What?
See you in a few...
No, under the cabinet. No.
The cabinet. That... Here. Let me... Click.
Doop.
I disconnected and did what I usually do after hanging up with John. Sat in dumbfounded silence and contemplated all of the poor choices in my life. I shrugged out of my coat, pulled off my Wally shirt, smelled it, then hung it back in the bedroom closet. As I pulled on a new shirt, I grabbed a bottle of caffeine pills from my desk drawer. I washed down four of them with a warm, half-empty bottle of Red Mountain Dew I found on the kitchen counter. I pulled on the coat and, after a moment's hesitation, dropped the Smith & Wesson in the pocket, the weight pulling the whole left side of the coat down on my shoulder. I felt like Bruce Willis.
Is it me, or is the barrel slightly warm?
I pushed through my front door and plunged into the cold, but made it no farther than the doormat. Footprints. The thin blanket of white across my front lawn should have been clean, save for a single trail of prints from the driver's side of my Bronco to the spot where I was standing. Instead, there was a haphazard circle of tracks in loops around my front yard, then trailing off around the back of the house. The trail of prints emerged from the other side and eventually led to the front porch, where I was now. I stepped off the porch and into the crunchy snow ice shell that coated the ground. I leaned down, squinting against the storm. Boot prints. Zigzag treads. I had a very dark, very lonely realization. The prints were mine. All of them. I glanced around in the darkness, seeing nothing but sparkling flecks of ice passing through shafts of streetlight. I made the silent decision to never tell anyone about this, and got in my truck.
Missing time, that's what they call it. John's got a missing girl, you've got a missing half hour. Shit.
I twisted the ignition to life, thought for a moment, then pulled the Smith from my pocket. I pressed the button on the handle and again popped out the magazine. I made a little pouch in my lap with my shirt and with my thumb, flicked out the bullets one by one. I counted as I went, hoping, no, praying, that none were missing. 1, 2, 3, 4. The bullets were, unusual. The heads were silver with a bright green plastic tip. A guy had mailed me these, anonymously. They were lined up in rows in a heavy white cardboard box, a tag on the inside typed with bullet jargon I didn't understand. Something about proximity fuses and long serial numbers. John and I test-fired them, shot a pumpkin and watched it explode into flaming bits of blackened shell. 7, 8, 9. That's what people do these days. They mail me things. Crystals, shrunken heads, doctored pictures of angels in clouds and of bleeding statues. Bundles of blue-lined notebook paper full of scrawled, rambly stories about Satan sending hidden messages through mass email subject lines. I've gotten chunks of stone stolen from haunted castles in Scotland, hunks of supposedly cursed black volcanic rock from Hawaii, dried Bigfoot turds. John and I have this reputation now, and everybody wants to help. 13? 14? I let out a long breath. One missing. One. The two-story, psycho-style house Big Jim Sullivan had lived in with his mentally handicapped sister would have cost most of $1 million had it not been run down and located in a weedy, desolate section of town, a block from a chemical drain cleaner factory. I guess the sister, Amy, lived here by herself now that Big Jim was deceased under circumstances I am rarely able to adequately explain in mixed company. I swung my headlights into the yard of the Sullivan Psycho House, between John's 1978 Caddy,
bearing the cryptic license plate CRKHTLR, and an undisclosed cop car that was parked along the road. It really was a shitty, shitty neighborhood. The next house over looked empty. The neighbor down the hill on the other side was an expanse of white parking lot dense with a wormy pattern of tire treads. It led to the ass of a huge building lined with a row of roll-up garage doors. The rear trucking entrance of the Drain Rooter plant. There was a single semi backed into one of the stalls bearing the logo of a cartoon plumber with a big red X through him. I wondered if the bathroom drains at the plant ever got clogged to the point that they had to call in a plumber, and, if so, if anyone was able to make eye contact with the guy while he was there. Through my windshield, I saw two figures in the front yard. One was John, arms jammed in his pockets, the stiff breeze sucking away cigarette smoke in a horizontal stream. The other was a bear of a man who I recognized as John's Uncle Drake, still the only cop in town with whom we were on a first-name basis. Drake spoke, John nodded, the ember of his cigarette bobbing slightly in the darkness. John was growing a beard. He had been working construction off and on after having been fired from Wally's a year before. He had gotten caught bootlegging DVDs and giving them away to customers right there at the store. Not selling them, mind you. Giving them away. I climbed out and was immediately assaulted by the freezing wind. The looming house didn't just look empty. It looked abandoned. It had gone downhill since I had last seen it on the night I tried to return Molly. Peeling paint, filthy windows, no tire tracks in the driveway. Big Jim had looked after Amy in the years since their parents died, but I don't know who was looking after her now. Apparently nobody, since she was lost and all. Man, it was cold. Drake looked shabbier than I did. The man inflated in full cop uniform and parka, complete with one of those navy blue fur earflap hats, the blue blimp of weariness. "Wong," he said, with a lack of enthusiasm usually reserved for door-to-door Mormons. "I don't enjoy our little encounters either, Drake, but here we are, just the same." "How long's she been missing?"
"Don't know. Neighbors saw her dog walking around the neighborhood this afternoon. They tried to return her and couldn't get anybody at the door. I came by and saw the—"
A skipped beat. A quick glance at John.
I thought you guys might know something."
"Tell him about your missing half hour."
I pushed that thought from my head and pretended it had never been there. Besides, I knew exactly where I had been during my missing time, walking around and around my yard in circles, right? Perfect sense. John flicked away his cigarette and crunched toward the front door. "Drake is gonna see if Amy is at a friend's house. She knows the Hoaglands, so he figures maybe she got scared off by the, The two of them shared a second "let's not discuss this now" glance. Opening the door to his cruiser, Drake said,
"You find anything, you call my cell, right? Then I handle it."
Making it clear that we weren't cops, that a missing person was still a cop thing no matter what weird acidness lurked inside this house. John tipped a finger at him and said,
"Yep. Thanks for calling us, Drake. You're the kind of man a man wants when a man wants a man."
Just inside the door was a little entrance hall with a black and white tiled floor, like a chessboard. There was a plate-sized chunk of tile missing near the wall, and the bare wood had been painted in it to match the pattern with what looked like magic marker and whiteout. I glanced into the kitchen. I froze. Molly? No question it was her. A red Labrador, whatever, fast asleep on the linoleum. I had the same thought from when we glimpsed her outside the abandoned mall that night. No way, just another dog of the same breed, surely.
"Oh, that's her," said John. "Go look at the collar, got the address on there and everything."
"But how?"
"Don't know. She answers to Molly, though, or at least as well as she ever did."
I wanted to go look closer, but I admit I was afraid to. Something coming back from the dead was almost always bad news. Movies taught me that. For every one Jesus, you get a million zombies. So the dog we saw explode, that wasn't Molly?
"Don't know.
Or maybe that was Molly, and this is, what, an imposter?" He shrugged.
"You should have seen me when I saw her here. I freaked out.
You think she's responsible for what happened to Amy? Maybe she, I don't know, ate her."
"Withhold judgment until you see the jellyfish."
I didn't ask.
I reluctantly turned my back on the resurrected dog, and we pushed through a living room with a green couch that looked to be from 1905, up a stairway into a darkened hall. There was an unlit light fixture on the ceiling and one of those old brass switch plates on the wall, the kind with the black buttons. I punched the top button. Nothing happened. John stepped carefully down the hall, squinting into the darkness. He turned and said, "No, that doesn't do anything. Hand me the flashlight." "You didn't tell me to bring a—" He held a hand out to shush me and ducked into a side door. We both stepped into a large room that, in the dim glow from the window, looked like a library of shelves, mostly filled with odd, shadowy shapes that were not books. I saw what looked like a bundle of cobweb hanging from the ceiling, and reached out to brush it aside. Pop! A shower of blue sparks flashlit the room. A bone-rattling electric sting flared up my elbow. The fixture on the ceiling blinked once, twice, and then bathed the room in light. About a foot in front of me was what looked like a bundle of wet string, suspended in the air by nothing at all. It didn't look so much like a jellyfish as a man of war, the slimy things that float lazily on the ocean surface and let their stringy tentacles hang down in the water. The creature drifted slowly up to the ceiling, toward the light. It wrapped its tentacles around the fixture and, to our utter astonishment, began frantically humping it like a puppy on a bunny slipper. The lights dimmed, finally flickering out to darkness again. The room was silent except for the soft rattling of glass vibrating against metal with each of the creature's spastic thrusts. "You ever seen one of those before?" John whispered somewhere in the darkness. Above us, a little blue spark jumped off one noodly tentacle to another with a soft fzz sound. I like to think I would have mentioned it if I had. "Uncle Drake shot it. Didn't seem to bother it much."
"He could see it?"
"Yeah, it's real." So that put it in the category of the mutants at the mall, and not the wig monsters and shadow people. I'd have to make a spreadsheet somewhere to keep track. And don't forget, just because Drake can see it doesn't mean another stranger from around town would. Lots of chances for a cop to get infected in this town. Ask Morgan Freeman. Now there was another train of thought badly in need of derailing. I said, "You got your lighter?" John flicked his Zippo and cast a pool of weak yellowy light around us. I glanced around, saw that only a couple of the shelves contained books, worn paperbacks with white fold lines. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, somebody named Terry Pratchett. Babylon 5 novelizations. The first, third, and fourth Harry Potter novels. Jim must have figured three was the most he could allow without risking turning Amy to witchcraft. The rest of the shelves were crammed with stuffed animals and junk. I saw a row of plates on little wire stands painted with the faces of Star Trek characters. The creature on the ceiling didn't react. "Well," I said, letting out a tired breath, "I was hoping it would attack your hand. I guess it's the electricity it likes and not the light." John slapped off the lighter and said, "I thought about opening a window and just shooing it outside."
That doesn't seem like such a good idea."
I thought for a moment, wondering vaguely if I had remembered to turn on the porch light back home.
"Can it, like, pass through walls?"
"It hasn't yet."
"Follow me."
We stepped out into the hall and I closed the door behind us.
"Okay," I said, "as long as nobody ever opens that door."
"Right. We'll put a sign on it or something," John said, the first problem solved. "The weird thing is down here. Check this shit." We went across the hall and he gestured into an ancient bathroom, complete with enormous cast-iron tub and a yellowing vanity with a cracked mirror. A steady stream of drips plunked from the faucet. A pair of scissors were wedged under one of the knobs, presumably to keep the valve from running freely. He punched the switch and the light flickered on, this one apparently unmolested. On the floor was what looked like a clear plastic bag filled with a marbled pink and yellow substance about the size of one of those giant bags of dog food. There was writing on the side in an odd angular font. John said, "That lock was bolted from inside. We had to jimmy it to get it in here. Water was running in the sink, toothbrush laying on the counter with dried toothpaste on it. That window is painted shut so there was no way out of the room. So she was in here, and then she wasn't. She never left the room, right?" The lock was one of those little slide bolts like you'd see on old public toilet stalls. The jimmy of the lock had been accomplished by smacking the door, probably with their shoulders,
until the little metal loop on the doorframe popped out of its screw holes. I leaned over and inspected the window. It looked to have been sealed long before I was born, not that it made a difference. Even if Amy had locked the door and crawled out of the window for some reason, dropping 15 feet or so to the ice below, how would she have gotten the window shut behind her? Can you think of a way that somebody could get that door locked from the other side? Like if they snatched her and then slid the bolt closed behind them? "What you're asking," said the irritating voice in my head, "is whether or not you could have done it, Dave." Bullshit, forget that. I was sure my bout of missing time, during which a bullet had left my gun, had nothing to do with this person who suddenly went missing on the same day. Two completely separate events. In fact, the event I was repressing was probably Amy coming to my house to borrow a bullet, and me calmly handing it to her.
"Sure," said John. "You could probably get the bolt slid in there with the door closed, give a guy 20 minutes, a bent wire coat hanger, let him try about 40 times. What would be the point, though? Just to mess with us?"
I nudged the bag on the floor with my foot. Dense liquid, a bag of sludge. He said, "The writing on the bag, that's a weight, right?"
"I guess."
I leaned down. 44.42 kilograms. I scratched my head.
"I give up."
"You, think that's her? In the bag?"
"Ew! No, let's assume not for now. That's just gross."
"You think the jellyfish ate her?
Bones and all?"
"We're talking about a tentacled flying lamp fucker, Dave. What are you prepared to call unlikely?"
I stepped out of the bathroom and wandered down the hall, passing a room stacked with cardboard boxes and some broken chairs. There was another door that had been nailed shut that seemed to lead out into midair.
John said, "You know what that is? They used to build these old houses with doors that just led to a big drop to fool burglars. They'd labeled that door Treasury or something like that. The guy busts in through the door and finds himself falling straight down. They'd put spikes or something down there. They used to call it an Irish elevator.
Or, John, they tore a balcony off here years ago and just never bothered to take out the door."
We passed a bare guest room that smelled of dust and old varnish. Then at the end of the hall came to a door standing open with a band poster stuck to the inside, a group called VNV Nation. I leaned into a chaotic bedroom, crammed with furniture and carpeted with wrinkly clothes. Posters on every wall, bands I'd never heard of, and one of a shiny Angelina Jolie as the Tomb Raider. There was a very nice laptop computer, a Mac, propped up on a pillow on an unmade bed.
"The computer," I asked. "Was it like that when you got here?"
"Yeah, we didn't touch a thing." On a nightstand off the bed, there were 4 empty plastic bottles with orange juice labels and a half a dozen brown prescription bottles. There was a box of Fruit Loops on the floor, open. I saw all this from the doorway but didn't step inside. I felt dirty for just peeking my head in, invading this person's space. John pushed past me, though, and I realized we probably didn't have a choice if we were serious about this. Cops do this every day, rifling closets and digging through your dildo drawer. I noticed the bed laptop was on, ironically in sleep mode, a single power light glowing along one side. I tapped the space bar, the screen fading up from black to reveal a white screen with blue text scrolling down.
"Check it out."
John nodded his head toward a dresser, one drawer half open, a couple of bras trying to escape. Atop the dresser sat a little black object, round and not much bigger than a roll of film, a lens in the center.
"A camera," I noted. "It's one of those wireless camera deals," he said. "For the computer."
"What, like a webcam?"
"Yeah, or something."
"Was this Jim's old room?" I asked, for some reason having trouble picturing Amy Cucumber Sullivan knowing how to shop for and use computer gadgetry. Before I encountered her while trying to return Molly a few years before, my only memory of Amy was from the life skills class at the Pineview Alternative School for Mentally Fucked Students, where I had spent my senior year. She always had her head down on her desk, asleep. To me, just a mop of red hair spilling over bony forearms. I think I only heard her say a dozen words my whole time there, and most of them were, "Please move or I'm going to puke on you." John muttered, "Dunno," in the way that people do when you ask a useless question that deserves nothing more. I glanced around and saw a second camera, a square one, sitting atop a shelf on a department store's sort of wood computer desk across the room. It wasn't aimed at the chair in front of it like you'd think a webcam would be, but sideways, toward the hole. "This camera is aimed over at the door," I deduced. I looked up and saw a ceiling fan with a set of four little canister lights aimed around the room. Taped to one canister was another of the wireless cameras. "And another one," I said, "aimed right at the window, all the entryways covered like a security system." A little tingle of nervousness rose in my gut for reasons I couldn't wrap my sluggish brain around.
"Okay," John said, moving toward the laptop. "You know, I just thought about something. Why would she lock her bathroom at all if she lived here alone? You'd just poop with the door open, right?"
I nodded and said, "So maybe she was already scared. If this were an episode of Law and Order, we'd have a nice shot of her getting abducted right on camera. And yes, before you give me that look of yours, I do realize whatever happened, happened in the bathroom and not in here. She didn't have a webcam in her bathroom, did she?"
"I want you to think about what you just asked."
John picked up the laptop and sat down with it in the computer chair. "Well," I said, "she could have caught somebody in the hall." That feeling again. It was like a faint alarm on the back of my skull, like the creeping sense that you've left something important at the house just as you're leaving for vacation. "He's going to look for the webcam stills on there."
"So?"
I shoved my hands in my pockets and wandered around the room, wondering how our getting first look at the evidence would fuck up a prosecution should this turn out to be a run-of-the-mill kidnapping and murder, flying jellyfish notwithstanding. Welcome to Undisclosed. I fingered a loose key in my pocket that had apparently fallen off the key ring. I ran my other hand through my hair, which was drying in a mushrooming carrot-top spray. I said, "Is there any place open in town that sells that Red Mountain Dew? I had some today. It's like somebody melted a box of Cherry Jolly Ranchers and stirred in some crack cocaine. Is that one convenience store on Lexington a 24-hour deal?" John wasn't listening. He was studying the flat monitor on the laptop. "For the webcam stills, to see who took Amy." My mouth was going dry, my heart thumping just a little too fast. The caffeine, probably. I leaned over John's shoulder and saw the phrase, "My cat peed on my bed," at the top of the screen. It was a series of broken lines, each beginning with a name in brackets. I knew the format. "That's a chat log. She was on there when she got up to brush her teeth. Then somebody took her, maybe somebody or maybe some thing. But the key is she knew they were coming somehow. She knew because she set up the camera so she would have Oh, shit. I stood bolt upright. "What are you going to say if that's you on the camera, asshole?" That thought, like a hammer to the balls. John actually glanced over to me, and I suddenly felt naked. I tried to remember what my body language looked like when I was at my most casual and innocent. Then the whole effect was ruined when I pulled my other hand from my pocket and saw what I was holding. It was the key to the tool shed in my backyard. I normally keep it on a nail near my back door. I do not normally keep it in my pocket.
"Oh, what did you put in the tool shed, Dave?"
I held up a declaratory, "I've got an idea" finger and said, "Wait." John turned to me, his sudden attention like a heat lamp on my face. I realized I had absolutely no idea what I was going to say next. We shouldn't do that yet.
"Okay. Why?"
"Because, I think it would be better if... Look, we have one witness to this thing, right?"
"We do?"
"Yeah. The thing, the jellyfish thing. I mean, we're up here dicking around with computers, and that thing could take off in the meantime, go back to wherever it goes. The computer isn't going anywhere." John glanced into the hallway and said,
"You think it talks?"
I looked him straight in the eye and said, "I think you can make it talk. Whether it wants to or not." He scratched his chin thoughtfully and said,
"I'll need a toaster."
"I saw one in the kitchen. Here, hand me the laptop. You go beat some information out of that slimy bastard." John strode out of the room with newfound purpose. I took his seat. The desktop wallpaper on the laptop was a photo of Orlando Bloom in full Lord of the Rings costume. I waited until I heard John's footsteps clomping down the stairs before I started clicking through folders, as fast as my fingers would go. Sweating a little now, my heart thumping against bone, my knee bouncing. I eventually stumbled across a folder full of little icons that came up as grainy camera stills. I clicked on one, saw a dim image of a lump sleeping soundly under the covers of the bed. Another, the same thing. A third, a shot of an empty bed. A fourth, the lump again. There were hundreds. I heard John stomp back up the stairs and I glanced toward the hall, not returning to my task until I heard him open the library door. I was stuck. Deleting the pictures was out of the question. I was not covering up a crime here, and at that point I fully intended to tell John if it somehow turned out I was the culprit we were after. But I wanted him to find out my way. I needed time to figure it out, to process it, to have some control over the revelation. I needed options. I cut the whole folder of pics and moved them to the most obscure location on the hard drive I could find, inside a subfolder of a subfolder of a subfolder of a subfolder of printer drivers. I closed up the computer and leapt up out of the chair, suddenly a bundle of nervous energy. You've got to get home. You've got to see what's in that tool shed. Yes, that was right. I plunged a hand into my pocket and clutched my car key so tightly they etched marks in my palm. I strode out and down the hall, feeling a cloud of guilt around me like a stench. I passed the library just as John came flying out, slamming the door behind him. He said, "That dangly bastard knows something. I can read it in his body language." I said, "I have to go." "Why?" "I just have to run home. I'll be back." "Yeah. You probably gotta check on the brownies. Can you get me some rubber gloves while you're at it?" "Okay." He opened the library door again and said, "Where'd you go, asshole?" Then once more closed himself inside the room. I fled. Driving again. Defrost heat blowing on the windshield, ice crystals melting on contact with the glass, swept aside by the wiper blade a second later. Wheels floating under me, no traction in the ice. The roads all to myself. If there's a body in your tool shed, say, of a skinny, retarded, red-headed girl, just come clean. To John first. Tell him exactly what happened. No need to plan beyond that. Gotta see what's there first. Gotta see. I turned on the radio, looking for something to blast the thoughts out of my head, hoping the moist nighttime air would blow a rare non-country station. I ground through static and static and static, then recoiled at the shrill, choking sound of a man apparently squealing through a crushed larynx. After a moment, I realized it was simply Fred Durst and the group Limp Bizkit, Shitload's favorite band. They're the ones who invented the musical technique of feeding a list of generic rap phrases to a goat, then reading its turds into a microphone over heavy metal guitar. This was the song Rollin', judging by the fact that the chorus was Fred saying the word several dozen times. Perfect. Rollin', rollin', rollin'. Just tell the truth. That's all I had to do. Just tell the truth. If I did it, I did it. I blanked and found a dead girl. No cover-up, no hiding the body or any of that. Just face the consequences. Sure, your dad will fly up and he'll tell you not to talk to anybody. And he'll make noise about your record of mental illness and use lots of big words. You'll get off because he's damn good at getting people off. And instead of jail, you'll get a stay in an institution smelling of ammonia and spoiled food, surrounded by people mumbling to themselves and smearing feces on the walls. It will work. It worked for the Hitchcock thing. No. Don't think about that. Keep rolling, rolling, rolling. From the darkness behind me, a very cold and very bony hand reached up and closed around my mouth. The hand squeezed, pulling my head back. I expected a blade on my throat. Instead, something long and cold and wet and twitching slid across my neck and down my shirt. I cranked the wheel and clawed at the hand. The truck skidded in the snow, jumped a curb, and smacked a newspaper machine with a crash of ruined metal and glass. With a jolt, the front tires blasted through a snowdrift and landed back on the street, wheels spinning, grabbing, then spinning again. The thing on my neck snaked across my collarbone and slid down my shirt, something with the texture of a slug or a leech, but long, its tail snaking up from my chest around my collarbone, a cool, twitching, itching weight on my skin. I screamed. I admit it. I blew through an intersection blinking yellow lights. I stomped around with my feet until I found the brake and went into a power slide, the rear of the truck trading places with the front. "No. No, keep driving," said a soft voice in my ear. "She will not bite if you keep driving." Fuck that. Fuck that idea like the fucking captain of the Thai fuck team fucking at the fucking tour de fuck. I stomped the brake and cranked the wheel. We skidded to a stop and I screamed again. A terrible, pinching pain pierced my breastbone. It was unreal, like my bones were sprouting razor blades. I screamed again and grabbed at the monster on my chest. A hand reached out and snatched my wrist with a quick, clean move.
"Be calm," said the voice. "Drive. Just drive. She will leave you alone. If you drive."
I didn't even hear this, not really. I got my other hand into my pocket and clawed free the pistol. A pain ripped through my chest again, unimaginable, like being torn in half. It crippled me. All of my limbs stopped in protest. The hand reached up from the back seat and very slowly took the Smith. Once more, he said,
"Drive. Just drive."
The pain relented. Huge gasps of breath tore in and out of my lungs. I squeezed my eyes shut, opened them again, and eased my foot onto the accelerator. I tried to look down at the thing that had me, its tail sticking out of the neck of my shirt. It had inch-long stalks all along its back, each ending in what looked like a small black eye. Several of the stalks tickled my chin as it wormed its way around, the end of the creature resting over my shoulder, squirming gently back and forth on the leather of my jacket. I heard the figure behind me shift on the upholstery, as if it was sitting in the back seat. I drove into the night, desperately trying to remember where I was going. I felt a drop of some kind of liquid crawl down my belly. I tried to say something cool, wound up stammering something like, "Wanna you wanna weenie me?" The end kind of trailed off in a shrill, choking warble.
"Just be calm. You're doing fine. Now, tell me what you were doing before I made myself known."
Who the fuck are you?"
"My name is Robert North."
"Congratulations. Now, who are you and what's this fucking thing you—"
"Please answer my question. Where were you going in such a hurry?"
"Home. Why? What's it to you? What's happening tonight?" I reached up and adjusted the rearview mirror to see in the back seat. It was just a man, thin, in his 30s, brown hair, buggy eyes, and a beak-like nose. He looked sort of English, but no matching accent. He spoke robotically, with difficulty. It's the way some deaf people talk, not able to hear their own inflection. He was wearing a white, furry woman's hat, what looked like a blue Walmart vest with a little plastic toy sheriff's badge tacked to the breast. He nodded toward the rear of the vehicle, where the stereo speakers were.
"That man in your, whatever you call it, your communicator, does he need help?"
"What?"
"He sounds wounded. Does he need your assistance?"
"You're not from around here, are you?
Why do you not respond to my questions directly?"
"That's just Fred Durst on the radio. He's not talking to us."
"Are you certain?" "It sounds as if he is crying out while someone is strangling him."
"I know. That sound is entertainment to many of us. It's called a song."
"I know songs, but I thought they rhymed."
I looked back again and saw the man was holding my gun by the barrel, studying it with detached curiosity. He had never held a gun before. I said, "I'm turning off the radio, so we can hear each other. Look." I very gingerly reached out and clicked off the power button. "Okay. I'm driving home. I live there. Can you tell me who you are and where you're from, or even better, who sent you?"
"I'm from right here, so far as you know it. Who sent me means very little right now. Why are you traveling home with such urgency in these conditions is of great importance."
"Did I kill the girl?"
"I do not understand the question. My interest is only in you and your desperation not to answer my question. I assure you that your own safety depends on your honesty."
The thing on my chest began pulsing gently, making gulping twitches. Okay, this bullshit has got to end. I'm neither brave nor reckless, but this was simply pissing me off too much. "I'm going to reach out again," I said, "to make an adjustment to the heat in here, okay?" I very slowly and non-threateningly punched in the cigarette lighter. "Now," I said, "I'm going home to check something in my tool shed, the little building behind my home, where I store things, okay?" He stayed silent for several seconds. A quick glance in the rear view showed a very grave expression on a bony face bathed in shadow and flickers of passing streetlights. The look of a man who's going to have his dog put to sleep.
Fascinating.
What? I glanced down at the lighter. The slug on my chest slowly curled its tail around, coming to rest along my neck and earlobe. It gave a little shiver. North stared off into the passing night and said,
They harvest insects here, do they not, for their honey? Do the bees know that they make honey for you? Or do they work tirelessly because they think it is their own choice? Have you never noticed that, after hearing a new word for the first time in your life, you'll hear it again within 24 hours? Do you ever wonder why sometimes you'll see a single shoe lying along the road?
A single tear rolled down his cheek. It occurred to me that the man was batshit insane. The lighter clicked. My heart leapt with anticipation, and I realized with disgust that the slug thing could feel the change. It twitched and fluttered as if it were feeding off the excitement, or the increased blood flow. I shifted my hands, the left on the wheel, the fingers on my right resting on the knob of the lighter. North didn't seem to notice me plotting my escape, but said,
I am at a loss. I have been watching you for some time, but there are great gaps in my knowledge. You know, I observed a man who masturbated until he bled. Did he want to do that? And you, when you were alone, you...
I yanked the lighter free, the coils orange with heat. I slammed on the brakes and cranked the wheel with my left hand. With my right, I jammed the lighter onto the lump on my shirt where I guessed the creature's head would be with a sharp hiss. The slug thing shrieked and thrashed wildly inside my shirt. The truck spun and tilted up on two tires for a sickening moment. The truck fell back down on four wheels with a thud. The lighter tumbled to the floor, a streak of orange in the darkness. A small yellow flame danced around a hole in my shirt where I had singed it with the lighter. I grabbed around for the slug thing, and for several terrible seconds, I felt its teeth brushing against my skin, jaws working, struggling to grab on. I wrestled it free, and suddenly I had it tight in my hands, slimy and writhing, slipping under my fingers. It had a little circle of tiny teeth, each curled and needle-sharp like fish hooks. There was a thin, straw-like appendage emerging from the center, about as long as my finger and whipping around, flecking little droplets of blood. I took one hand off it and opened the driver's side door. I flung the flopping thing out onto the snowy middle of the street. I spun around in my seat and saw Mr. North pawing around the floorboard, the gun nowhere to be seen. I threw a wild punch at his face. North flung himself back in an effort to dodge it and gave me a shot at the gun, laying half under the seat below me. I threw my torso back there, my feet kicking around at the windshield. In a scramble of elbows and hands, I grabbed the pistol and twisted my body around. I jammed the barrel under his chin. We sat like that for a long moment, both of us breathing puffs of steam as the icy wind poured in the open door. I thought I could hear a soft thumping sound, our slug friend trying to deal with life in a world of ice. Okay, I breathed, okay. Okay, this thing I've got pointed at you, you know what it does? He nodded, said,
I believe I have an idea, yes.
And have you ever heard the old human saying, I want to shoot you so bad my dick's hard?
I have not, but I believe the context makes its meaning clear.
Shut up. Don't move. I crawled back into the front seat, keeping the sights on him until I dropped my legs out of the driver's side door and stood up into the wind. I looked around the street for the squirming monster. It had crawled all the way to the sidewalk. I crunched over toward the creature, lifted a boot, and stomped on it. I grunted random curses under my breath as I pounded the thing again and again, hammering with my boot heel. The slug exploded in a spray of brown and red. The red blood, I assumed with disgust, was mine. I kept stomping, little flecks of ice spraying with each impact, until the monster was a wet, twisted stain. I kicked the shredded remains into a sewer grate nearby, then stomped back toward the truck. Sweat freezing on my face, my nose running freely. My teeth were clenched, my hands squeezed on the gun so tight I could feel the pulse in my palm. From a few feet away, I could see that the back door of the truck was open now, and when I got there, I was not surprised to see that North was gone. I slammed his door. I got in. I drove home. I saw just one other vehicle while I was out, a snowplow. I passed a cop in a convenience store parking lot messing with the chains on his tires. He shot me a look as I passed, like I was insane for even leaving the driveway in this mess. I had to pull over once and go over my windshield with my ice scraper, the wipers unable to keep up with the storm. I pulled alongside the road by my house and left the engine running. I crossed the yard, the network of footprints now just soft craters under the new snow and ice. I clasped the tool shed key in my left hand.
You have an alibi. You were at work all day, right?
Sure, yeah, that's right.
But who knows when she actually went missing? It could have taken days for anyone to notice, even if it was last night.
I was in bed last night, 11 p.m.
Were you? Can you account for every minute you think you were asleep?
There's one period when you distinctly remember being a pirate, raiding a cruise ship full of naked women.
Could you have been up and prowling and imprisoning a girl in your tool shed?
No. No way.
Maybe you had her tied up out there all day and you came home and decided you finally had to get rid of your plaything, or put it out of its misery. So you came in and got your gun and...
I suddenly pictured the answering machine on the little table by my front door. John had called, the red light blinking. Slowly. Slowly.
The new message light blinks fast, like a strobe. The machine tonight was signaling a saved message, one already played.
No, I'd remember.
Would I?
I thought of last summer, a month after Lopez and I broke up. She showed up at a bar where John's band was playing. I had drunk, oh, probably 700 beers. I wound up back at her place, a rented house she shared with some other girl. The night was a lost blur. I remember sweat in my eyes, my own breath blowing back to me off her neck, damp sheets, and a fly. This fly that kept buzzing and landing on my back and my neck, tickling me, waking me up again and again through the night. The rest is lost. Days later it gets back to me, through one of Jennifer's friends, that I had gone on a drunken, tear-filled rant about how hell was waiting for me and there was nothing I could do to avoid it. I said it was bullshit, that Jen had made it up to make me look stupid. But had she? How would I know? Some memories bury themselves so, so deep. And just like that, flashes of memory came pulsing in, like forgotten fragments of a dream.
You do remember. You remember rushing into the house and digging out the big book from the nightstand. You yanked the gun free and plunged out into the cold.
With the key clasped in my hand, I crossed the yard. Continued around the house. The trail of prints that led back there were gone now, the space between the houses a wind tunnel that seemed to burn my ears right off my head. The Andersons lived next door. They were in Florida. The next house over was vacant, a realtor's for sale sign buried under the snow in the front yard. A single gunshot carried by the wind? Who would call the cops? You wake up and you're not even sure you heard it. In the backyard now. Dimly lit by a dusk-to-dawn light off my back door. Just enough light to see the pool of pink slush right in the middle of the snow. A metal wire tightened around my gut.
Did you actually feel sorry for yourself a few minutes ago, having to live your life in an institution or jail? That's an actual girl's actual blood, Dave. She was warm in her home and ready to curl up in bed, and next she was wrestled away or knocked cold. What do you remember? You remember the flare of light and the gun jumping in your hand, then digging around the snow for the brass casing and not finding it. Night-blinded from the muzzle flash, ears ringing with the sound. And just like that night with Jennifer. You knew it was the last thing you wanted to do, but still, you did it and you did it and did it. You never stopped, Dave.
I reached the door and tried to wedge the key into the frozen padlock, my fingers shaking. I dropped the key once, twice, then wrapped the frozen lock in my palm to warm it. Finally, I got the key in and twisted it and popped the lock free.
A burst of fire in the darkness, the sharp crack of a gunshot, night blindness, panic, frozen breaths, blue canvas.
I pulled open the door, scraping it along the frozen ground. The piano wire around my gut tightened again, and I thought I would have been sick had I eaten anything. I have this tarp, a blue one. One I always used to keep my firewood dry before I ran out of firewood. Right now, it was in a loose roll along the gravel floor of my tool shed, above another frosted stain of cranberry-colored slush. There was something wrapped in the canvas, something the size of a body, something I knew was a body, rolled up like a murder burrito, a gutted deer in the bed of a pickup. I could have confused this for a slain young deer, in fact, had there not been three pale fingers extending just over the edge of the canvas. I turned away, stepped outside, put my hands on my knees. Breathe. Slow, deep breaths. I stood upright, let the steam rise past my eyes, my soul making a run for it. Knees felt like jello. I lay back against the door frame of the shed, then felt it sliding against my back. My ass was cold suddenly. Snow soaking in. I was surprised to see I was sitting, legs splayed out in front of me. No strength to stand. You guys know my sister, who's back home at this moment, in that big old house. If one of you makes it out of this instead of me, I want you to look in on her. Make sure she's taken care of. She ain't never been on her own. I want you to promise me. In the end, the people riding in the back of that beer truck couldn't protect her. They couldn't protect her from me. There was no question in my mind I had done it. I didn't want to do it, to be sure, but I had done it just the same. And the thought, the gargantuan thought that swallowed me the way the impossible idea of eternity will swallow me upon arrival in hell, was that nothing would ever, ever, ever be right again. Christ! The weight of it. No shit, asshole. That's why you have to act. She's dead. You're not. Think. Do you know what they do to guys like you in jail? The river isn't frozen over yet. Just take the body and dump it. Cut off the head and the hands and dump it. This isn't your fault. No. I wouldn't do that. I had a vision of friends and family, and she had to have family somewhere, living the rest of their lives not knowing what happened to Amy Sullivan. No. They deserve to know. They deserve to know I did it, and to see me strapped to a table with a needle in my arm. I made myself breathe. One step at a time, that was the only way to handle things after they spun out of control. Step one, breathe. Step two, stand up. Go inside the shed. Take a look. Make sure it's her. Oh, hey, that's right. You might have a whole collection of corpses stacked around here. Then go to Amy's place and tell John. Just tell him. No bullshit. Then call Drake and show him the body. Tell him the truth. Tell him I blanked out and there she was. Let's face it, if I'm this dangerous, it's better that I be locked up, for everybody's safety. I climbed to my feet, put my hand on the door. Okay, fine, just go in and unwrap her and face this thing. Just face what you did. And closed it. I snapped the padlock shut, then trudged inside the house. Chapter 11. By the way, looking back, if I had gone in and seen what was in the tool shed, I would have put a bullet in my own skull 1 minute later. Chapter 12. Amy. I followed my own tire tracks as I made my way back through town. I kept the dome light on and threw nervous glances behind me every 4 seconds or so. At Amy's house, I found John hunched under the hood of his Cadillac. I walked past him. The horrible news coiled inside me like one of those chest bursters from Alien. I said, "Your battery dead?" "I hope not." I noticed a set of jumper cables coiled in the snow around his feet. Hooked around one elbow was a knotted string of what looked like Christmas tree lights. "Christmas is coming late for that motherfucker, soon as I find it. You got my gloves?" "No." "Okay. Can I have a brownie?" He caught a glimpse of my face as I passed. He stood upright, alarmed. "Dave, what's up? Did you change your shirt?" "Put that stuff back. I think I got it figured out." "What? You do?" I stepped into the warm house, thinking this was going to be another of life's little awkward conversations. I absently rubbed the cold from my fingers. I heard John approach the door, and suddenly ideas hit me, quick and desperate, panicked wild fastballs of thought. I could tell them it was an accident. "Yeah, you can make it work. You can march people up to testify about the time you severed an artery in your arm trying to carve a pumpkin. You can pull the emergency room records from the time Jennifer had to rush to get you a half cup of candle wax scraped off your scrotum. There was the hot glue gun incident. People would believe it, would see that you're not a murderer, but merely an incredible dumbass. You see, officer, I was driving past the house, and I observed through the window what appeared to be some kind of shaved baboon, apparently escaped from a nearby circus. The animal was clearly thin and malnourished, which I believe made it an even greater threat to the inhabitants of the home. Naturally, I produced a weapon and subdued the creature with a single gunshot. Now, interestingly, it was at this moment that my penis accidentally fell out, and I found myself,
crunk,
creunk, above me, creaking floorboards. I stopped, held my breath, listened. The wind? Above me, a door clicked shut. I stepped quickly and softly toward the stairs, eyes on the darkened doorway at the top. I glanced back at John. The startled look on his face told me he hadn't invited any company over. I pulled the Smith from my coat and pointed it up the stairs. Come on down, fuckers. Come on down. Come see David on the worst day of his life, destined for forever in jail or worse, still with 14 bullets left to spend. Whatever you are, you picked the goddamn staircase on the wrong goddamn day. Come on down. I heard another door open, then close. Are the most dangerous creatures the ones that use doors or the ones that don't? I eased myself up the stairs one at a time, softly. My feet hit the creaky wood floor of the hallway. Every door in the hall was closed, but one, the bedroom. The library seemed like the logical one to check first. I quietly cranked the brass knob until the door clicked free. Nothing but darkness. I tried the light, and it came right on. No jellyfish. I backed out, took a step, and tried the door on my right, the bathroom. No need for the light. I could see right away that the room was empty, and look at that. The fat bag was gone. Toward the bedroom now, the gun in front of me in both hands, arms rigid like the turret on a tank. The old sensations again, blood pumping past my ears, sparks flying in my brain, that cool sweat again. My clothes must have stank of it. Something moved in the shadows, a thin figure, almost as tall as a man. A gray torso, like a rhino. It saw me and froze. A trickle of sweat crawled down my forehead, landing as a burning speck in my left eye. Holy shit, it's a shaved baboon! Through the sights of the pistol, I saw a young, very thin and pale girl, draped in a gray University of Notre Dame sweatshirt that she wore like a dress. I said, "Oh, Amy, hey." An avalanche of relief buried every thought in my mind. Amy took several steps backward. She was holding a toothbrush and was nervously rubbing the bristles with her thumb as she retreated toward her door. Her other arm ended in an empty sleeve. "Hi," she said in a too loud squeak. "Can I, help you?" "No, no, it's fine. We were just worried about..." I made a huge mistake. I reached out casually, I thought. It's hard to come off casual with a gun in your other hand, I guess, to take her arm. I had to see if it was her, if she was solid. I wrapped my fingers around a very solid and very real forearm, but then she pulled away, and when I went to catch the spot where her hand would be, I grabbed only air. She ducked back through the bedroom door and slammed it shut. I looked stupidly down at my empty fingers and realized two things. Amy Sullivan was alive, and she no longer had a left hand. "Wait! Hey!" I said, screaming and pounding on the door while wielding a handgun, in exactly the way an armed rapist would. "It's me!" "Okay," she said, as I heard something scoot across the floor and jolt the doorknob. She had braced the door with some piece of furniture, probably the chest of drawers. "No, it's fine. I'm not armed. I mean, I'm armed, but not in a bad way. We've been looking all over for you." "I'm here," she said in the artificial sweetener tones you'd use to soothe a rabid dog. "You can leave." I stuffed the gun in my jacket pocket and leaned toward the door. "Hey, where have you been?" Nothing from inside. I could hear her talking faintly in there, like she was mumbling to herself. Poor kid. I wandered back to the stairs, one question answered with several dozen new ones replacing it. First off, who did I kill? John came up the steps saying, "Who was talking up here?" "I found her. She was in the bedroom." He glanced that way and said, "Damn, you're good. So she was here the whole time, like folded up in a desk drawer?" "I don't know, John, and I don't care. She wants us to leave."
"You sure?"
"John, we have to talk." I turned him around and we stepped down into the living room, just in time to see red and blue lights pulsing across the bay window. We reached the front door just as Officer Drake pushed his way in.
"What's the deal?" Drake said, brushing snow off his shoulders. "We got a 911 call from Amy saying there was an armed man in the house."
Drake went upstairs to calm Amy down while John and I waited down at the dinner-style chrome and green table in her kitchen. John pulled out a small package of what looked like tobacco and asked, "You think she'd mind if I smoked in here?" "John, I killed somebody." As the words hung in the air, I had a split second to wonder how many people have ever uttered them and still gone on to live happy lives. I said, "There's a body in my tool shed." "Is it Jeff Wolflake? Does that mean the manager job is open?" "No. A guy showed up. A guy, but maybe not a guy, on the way home. He put a thing on me like a slug or something and asked me a bunch of questions." "And you killed him?" No, he got away. I killed some other person, completely unrelated to that guy, apparently. I was just putting that out there."
"Okay. So who is it?"
"Dunno. I didn't check. I remember doing it, though, sort of. I shot them with the Smith. There's a bullet missing and everything. I remember doing it, but I don't remember wanting to do it." John eyed me carefully. He looked away and pulled his hair back, then tied it with a rubber band. He pulled out a small box and shook out a rolling paper, then opened the tobacco. He said,
"You think it was like the thing with Danny Wexler? The demon thing we ran into at the mall?"
"At the mall," he says. "Like we saw it folding pants at American Eagle.
I serve none but Korok." "You know," he said, "the way they could take hold of people, move them around like puppets? Then you shot me? You gonna bring that up again? You think it was Jennifer you killed?"
I hadn't thought of that. "No, I mean, that was amicable, right?" He didn't answer. I pulled out my cell phone and pulled Jennifer Lopez's number off my speed dial menu. One ring, then three, then six, eight. Finally,
"Hello."
I knew the voice, sleepy and drunk, sure, but hers. I broke the connection. "She's there," I said.
"Well, that's everybody you know.
But if it was that thing controlling me, it wouldn't be somebody I wanted dead. It would be somebody it wanted dead."
"Holy shit, this is madness,"
John said.
"So it could happen again."
I opened my mouth to respond, then closed it. I actually hadn't thought of that either. John started laboriously sprinkling tobacco onto a cigarette paper. I said, "She may not want you to smoke that in here, John."
"Yeah, I gotta make them ahead of time anyway. I get the urge to smoke. I don't want to sit and mess with it. You get the tobacco too clumped in the middle and it doesn't stay lit. Rolling is a pain in the ass.
You know, I think you can buy them now where they're already made." He started rolling the thing, unrolled it, tried again. I lowered my voice and leaned in.
"Hey, John, when I saw Amy, I think her hand was missing." "Well, yeah, it's been like that for a long time. She was in an accident."
"Oh, and she lives here alone?"
"Yeah, why?"
"There's nobody who, you know, comes by to take care of her?" John studied me for a moment, then said,
"Well, Dave, I think one of the neighbors comes by to put out food and water in a bowl for her. Let her out, you know."
"What?"
"Nothing."
We snapped into silence as Drake appeared in the doorway, Amy barely visible behind him. She squeezed around him, the girl now fully dressed in street clothes and even shoes. She wasn't going anywhere, not at this time of night and not in this weather. Must be her hosting outfit. She had chin-length copper hair that looked like she had cut herself. Something weird with her eyes, the wrong shade of green. On top of all that, she still didn't have a hand. As she came into the room, I averted my eyes from the handless arm that didn't swing quite right when she walked, and then realized it was becoming obvious that I was averting my eyes, so I looked at the scarred stump where her wrist ended. Then it became so obvious I was looking at it that she actually folded her arms, her wrist disappearing behind her shirt sleeve. She glanced past me and said, "Hi, John."
"What's up? This is Dave, the one you saw in your hallway. He's not a psychotic killer or anything."
He lied.
"Oh, I know. We went to school together."
"Yes, Amy, let's reminisce about the Pine View Behavior Disorder Program. Remember that time they had to restrain Schizo Bobby Valdez and one of the aides broke his arm? Ha 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 ha." I said, "Hey, I'm sorry about the, you know, almost shooting you. We just have some questions and then we'll leave you alone."
She looked at me with the too long stare of someone with no social skills or diminished mental capacity. Like John said, I knew she had been in an accident as a kid. Brain damage? Was that her thing? I thought about the pills on the nightstand. She held her gaze as she said, "It's okay." She waved a dismissive hand in the air and smiled. "So are you guys with the police or what?" "Damn, you're cheery. Does one of those pill bottles contain Vicodin, dear?" "Oh, no. John knows Officer Drake here, and he just called us to help out. We're, sort of experts on..."
"Oh, I know," she said brightly. "I've read about you guys. There's this website I go to, like a news of the weird sort of thing. I think you guys are mentioned in every other article. The thing with Jim... when Jim... well, you know. I did a lot of reading. Do you want something to drink? I have, cranapple juice and..." She spun and opened the fridge. "And... water? And pickles?"
"No, thanks." She closed the refrigerator and took a chair at the table opposite John and me. Drake said, "She doesn't remember a thing. She lost about 20 hours, as far as I can tell."
I said to her, "What's the last thing you remember?" "Brushing my teeth. I had the brush in my hand. I had gone downstairs to let Molly out so she could pee and roll around in the snow. She likes that. I came up and was putting toothpaste on the brush, and then the light was off. All of a sudden. Just like that. The toothbrush was back on the shelf and the water was off, and I don't remember anything in between. Then I heard somebody in the hall, and it turned out it was you."
"And you were on your computer right before you went in?"
Hesitation. "Hiding something?"
"Yeah, I think so." "Nothing strange happened?"
"When?"
"That night. The nights leading up to it."
"No,"
she said, studying my face as some bad liars do, always seeing if you're buying it. No practice, this girl.